this retreat, the way of practicing Vipassana meditation, looking into the way things are. This is a really rare opportunity, because so much of human existence is just reactive actions, conditioned, and very few people have the opportunity to really kind of take time to contemplate existence. And then we have these tools, these very skillful tools of the Buddha to use. As you can see now, many of you are beginning to gain confidence and respect for the Buddhist teachings, because you now have some experience, first-hand experience. It's no longer just theoretical kind of teaching, interesting and inspiring, but now you've put it into application, into practice, to the way things happen to be on this retreat, both individually, personally, as a community, the weather. We can't help the weather, can we? Just the changing conditions of sensory existence, external to the body, internal to the body, to the mind. With the Vipassana teachings, that is really looking into everything that we are experiencing, with these three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Because these apply to everything that exists. The common characteristics of all existence is anicca, impermanence. All conditions are impermanent. Now, a reflection on impermanence, on anicca, if carried through to its logical insight knowledge, is that you experience signlessness. Things end and cease in themselves. You're aware of the ending, the cessation of conditions that have arisen. It's not just theoretical knowledge or going on the assumption that because some things, a few things that you've noticed see arise and cease, it's actually penetrating cessation as you're experiencing it, arising and ceasing as you're experiencing it now. It's not just assuming that everything arises and ceases because it seems reasonable thing to assume. So Vipassana is taking the impermanent nature, the characteristic of impermanence, until you penetrate that truth with this insight knowledge, jnana-dasana. So you really need to know arising. It's like with thoughts, to have things arise, you need to deliberately think. If you're just caught in an endless stream of obsessive thinking and wandering mind, you can never notice the arising and ceasing. You're just reacting. So that this is where skillful means is necessary. We need to apply skillful means. Like with thinking, we need to investigate thought by intentionally thinking and observing the arising of a thought, the beginning of it, the ceasing of thought, the cessation of thought, of feeling, of all desires, they cease in your mind, don't they? Fears that have arisen cease in your mind. Anger that arises ceases in your mind. Greed ceases in your mind. Delusions, all delusions cease. If they arise, they cease. Now, talking like this is good enough, but the practice is the willingness to use every opportunity to see the cessation of that which has arisen. Through the ayatanas, through the eye, you contemplate eye contact, and the conditions dependent for eye consciousness. You have to have light, don't you? You have to have a proper eyes that function. If you're blind, of course, it doesn't work. If there's no light, so that sight, eye consciousness is dependent. It arises and ceases. We're not always looking at things. Eyes can be open and still not conscious of anything as an object of sight, even though there is peripheral vision. But if you're listening to something or eating something or feeling something, then there's no eye consciousness at that time, even though your eyes still function. So consciousness is where the actual object is known. There's not just peripheral vision. With the ear, every sound begins and ends, isn't it? It's so obvious. That sound is a fleeting kind of experience. Just trying to catch a musical note or a sound, it's the perfect example of arising and ceasing. Smell, taste, touch, thought. That's anicca and dukkha. If you investigate dukkha, you see the unsatisfactory nature of conditions, that there's nothing truly satisfying in conditioned phenomena. Because of its impermanent nature, because it is the way it is, we take this sign of dukkha, of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness. And how does that apply to things we find satisfaction in? That satisfaction itself is a temporary state. An attachment to even the feeling of being satisfied leads to dissatisfaction. Not that there's anything wrong with being satisfied, but attachment to satisfaction leads to a sense of anxiety or dissatisfaction. Just notice here in this retreat, and when you're in a very tranquil state, you're sitting there in a very peaceful, calm, concentrated, blissful state, and some irritating sound or a disruptive thing happens, and do you feel irritation? Do you feel annoyed, a bit angry, averse to anything that disrupts? And the more you attach to that tranquil, pleasant state, how wonderful it is, the more you want it, the more you're going to start dreading the going back to life where you can't have it so much. Like, I don't want to have to go back and work in the kitchen. I don't want to have to go into London. I don't want to have to go to those meetings. I don't want to have to do the gardening. I don't want to... Oh, that's, it's like, how can you meditate if you have to cut the grass? How can you meditate if you've got to do the dishes? How can you meditate if you're cooking food? How can you meditate if you have to go teaching here, go teaching there, teaching in the Buddhist society and then to these different Buddhist groups? All I do is stir you up. All I want is to sit here in this state of bliss. That's suffering, isn't it? Even though the bliss is exactly that, the pleasantness of that is certainly pleasant, is no... Not saying it's unpleasant in any way, but attachment to that, upadana, desire to keep it, and the upadana, the grasping, and then the power becoming someone who wants it and feels angry, upset when you can't have it. So there's pavadanha with pavadanha. So one can feel with refined states of consciousness. The thing, the suffering about refinement is that it makes us very unhappy and dread having anything less than the best. We just feel very threatened, very worried, dreading the fact that we might have to be with something inferior or less than refined or coarse or unpleasant. When my first year in in meditation, I was alone so much, and I used to attain these really kind of beautiful states. I'd be sitting there just in blissful consciousness. And then I'd have to do something like, well, I have to go get my visa. So one day they had an immigration office in Nong Khai, and I thought, well, I can go to this immigration office. My upachaya said that they would probably help me there. I wouldn't have to go all the way to Bangkok to extend this visa, because Nong Khai was the town that you crossed from Nong Khai into Laos to go to Vientiane. So I remember feeling in this very blissful state, going through the town in this blissful state. Suddenly I felt love for everybody. I looked at everyone, and the kind of pity, tears would rise up in my eyes. And there's a tremendous kind of feeling of compassion for everything. And then I walked into the immigration office, and wham! I was so sensitive that I picked up immediately that I was persona non grata. Because suddenly I felt this great wall of aversion coming toward me. Nobody seemed to want to help me. They looked at me as if I was an inconvenience and a nuisance. And it really upset me. I nearly broke down right there. I was so attached to this state. And anything like that, you're so sensitive that feeling, which, say, in an ordinary conscious state, would have just been, well, so what? You wouldn't have been so demolished by it. But in that heightened state of awareness, it was really coarse and painful. Not that they didn't hit me, they didn't beat me, they didn't even tell me to get out. They just were not very nice, very friendly, in the cold and not eager to help and short with me. Well, anyway, I was absolutely demolished by it. I was in such a sensitive state. I remember reading the poems of the German poet Rilke, where even the sound of a falling leaf used to set him into a state of anguish. And I used to think, oh, that's going too far. I hope to be caught in such anguished feelings over just the fall of a leaf, you couldn't very well live your life in that state without being continuously bombarded with anguish. But then I understood, in a certain heightened state of awareness, you're incredibly delicate and super sensitive. So a lot of coarseness that are in just daily life existence is very harsh, which, say, for ordinary daily life isn't for us, isn't it? When we're more grounded with the earth. So I rushed back to the monastery, and I was upset for about 3 or 4 days. I couldn't get back to this delicious state of heightened awareness and this ecstasy. And finally I got back there, and I wanted to stay. Then I became desperate to hold on to it. I didn't want to respond to anyone or anything. I was timid and frightened to go anywhere, because realizing the potential for being demolished again, I began to lose it before anything ever happened, because of the dread, the anticipation, the worry that came when at the thought of having to do anything that other than just kind of stay in one place and abide in this very blissful conscious state. So the attachment, even though the consciousness was valid and beautiful experience, it became a source of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness for me because of the attachment to it, wanting to keep it, and then resenting, having aversion to anything that threatened it. It became quite impossible for me to even talk to anybody. So dukkha, say, the reflection on this, even the attachment to the finest is dukkha. Attachment to anything is dukkha, because the very characteristic of all conditioned phenomena is that it is unsatisfied. It's no way that we can keep it. There's no way that we can really possess it. There's no way that we can keep it forever and hold on to it and protect it and defend it all the time. It's always under threat, isn't it? Conditions are always changing, and they're always, and if we're attached to them, then there's always the fear of losing. There's always the threat of them being demolished or taken away from us. Like being wealthy, isn't it? If you have a lot of money, then there's always the anxiety that it's going to be taken away from you. People want money, don't they? Everybody wants money, at least most everybody wants money. So that you know that people want money. And so when you're attached to wealth, then of course there's always this anxiety connected to that. So being wealthy is unsatisfactory, is dukkha. When you don't have any wealth, you don't like just think, if each one of you had £1 billion in the bank right now, in the New Westminster Bank in London, each of you had £1 million stashed away, what would that do to your meditation here? Being anagarikas or dasadharas and all that, what would that do to your... We would have an influence, wouldn't it? The perception of £1 million in the bank. When you get bored and fed up with sitting, then you go, I've got £1 million in the bank. I could find the best place for meditation. I could buy a place in Tahiti. I could... so that, because why don't we have these thoughts? Because we don't have any money, do we? And still, if we had each had £1 million in the bank, we'd still be thinking about it. It'd still be there in the mind, even if we vowed that we're not attached to it, that we wouldn't mind if it just disappeared. But as long as it has that sense of being me and mine, it has that effect of influencing consciousness. It's just the way it is. That's why for the life of a samana is the relinquishment of ownership to wealth, so that our minds just don't think about it. There's no perception of owning things in the mind. There's not a perception of having money. I don't have any perception at all of having any money. That perception doesn't arise in my mind because I haven't had any money for 20 years. So that the perception of money as me and mine just doesn't arise. That just doesn't appear. Being celibate, also, living celibate life, the kind of interest in sexual things, that falls away. And so the perception of, the sexual perceptions drop away from the mind. So that the opportunity, the possibility for that kind of activity doesn't exist for us, doesn't it? Because of our vows. So that identity that goes with that, that interest, that possibility, that little hesitation and longing, we begin to see as Dhamma and let it go, so the mind doesn't incline in that direction. Now the most lovely states of consciousness, the Brahma Viharas and the fine material world and the immaterial realms and all that, even though they are truly beautiful in themselves, yet as objects of desire they become suffering for us. Because of the way things are, having a body like this, we cannot abide very long. I mean, Brahmas are supposed to abide in Brahma realms like 84,000 eons of radiance, radiating golden light through their bodies. Now that would be really a wonderful thing to do for 84,000 eons, wouldn't it? Imagine the kind of ability to radiate golden light through your body for 84,000 eons. You know, what a positive thing to be doing for 84,000 eons. Maybe it doesn't appeal to you, does it? But if you really get that feeling of radiation, it's just very pleasant. If you really take up radiating metta or radiating light through your body, if you really begin to do that, it is extremely blissful state to be in, that radiance where you're radiating things. So 84,000 eons of radiating light, golden light, sounds absolutely fantastic. Sounds really wonderful, doesn't it? Because that ability to radiate is quite a blissful feeling in itself. But we can't do that anyway, because of these human bodies. They aren't very efficient at radiating things, are they? They have to deal with so many coarse functions and kind of painful conditions and the aging process and sickness and enervation and all that, so that even though we can at moments feel this radiance, we have to spend a lot of our daily life just coming to terms with the coarseness of a human body, feeding it, bathing it, dressing it, keeping it warm, when it gets too hot trying to keep it cool, when it gets sick trying to make it feel better, when it gets tired to rest it. And how much of our life is just spent trying to keep the body from being too painful and unpleasant? Think of that. How much of our lifetime has to be, we have to dedicate toward maintenance and care of this physical body to keep it from being too painful, too unpleasant? Because if we don't take care of it, then it becomes very painful, very unpleasant, sickly kind of condition. So 84,000 eons of radiating golden light through the human body is not on our plate in this lifetime, is it? I mean, we do have moments of radiance, but then if we have to go to the loo or something, it's hard to maintain that same radiance. We have to come down and touch the earth, kind of deal with the visa in the immigration, with the functions of the body, with the societal problems, with the weather, and all in all like this, so much of our life has to be on that plane of just being able to bear with and work with the coarse conditions of planetary life. Now, if your whole desire and longing is for the refined state of radiance, mental radiance, then of course you'll find all this, so many obstacles in the way, you just feel frustrated and annoyed. And that's the suffering of grasping those high levels of consciousness, the memories of having them, and wanting them, desiring, bhava-danha, isn't it? Then having bhava-danha, then there's vipava-danha, the aversion to the coarseness, the grossness, the dreariness, the mundane earthly conditions. So we have to reflect that this lifetime we have to work on this plane of human experience. With all that implies. I mean, this is where our reflection allows us to get a perspective on it, that this is the way life is. Old age, sickness, death, grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish are a part of our experience of human existence. Sickness, isn't it? Death of the human body, aging of the human body, in all that goes along with that. The separation from beloved, and we feel so attracted to each other, and then the separation. There's always a bit of anguish in it, a bit of sadness when you have to separate from someone that you really, really like. There's always a feeling of slight feeling of anguish that goes with that. Or having to be with someone you don't like. Having to do something you don't want to do, having to be someplace that you don't want to be in, is suffering. These are common to all human beings. So reflecting on dukkha allows us to see that the insight of wishlessness, not desiring, we have the insight knowledge to realize that it's to let go of desire, wishlessness, to not create wishes in our mind, hold on to wishes all the time. So there's desirelessness, wishlessness that comes from reflecting on experience as dukkha, seeing the dukkha in the conditions. So there's anicca, dukkha, and then anatta. Anatta, not self, not me, not mine. Anatta is not a denial not meant to be a kind of doctrinal denial of things. It's not a metaphysical teaching, in other words. We're not making a metaphysical doctrine out of anatta. The Buddha never did that. He's not coming from that position, but from actual experience and reflective knowledge of the way things are. We see that anatta in regards to the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana, anatta, that these changing conditions, these unsatisfactory conditions, are not me, not mine. Like we, during this retreat, I've been emphasizing the way of looking at things as like perceptions, as just that. They are what they are. Anger is just anger. So that you're looking at something that we tend to regard as me and mine, my anger, as just what it is. It's honest, direct seeing, isn't it? It's not saying it doesn't exist or that it's an illusion. We're not trying to say that it's an illusion and not really there. We're not trying to say that you're not really experiencing anger. We're not trying to dismiss it, talk about love in the moment when we're feeling anger, that you should love everyone. But we're looking at anger as it is. If you look at the perception of anger, it's just that. It's anger, but it's only what it is. It's not, has no personal quality. You've stopped the movie. The film is just like caught in the film is just at that point is just like a piece of plastic, has no life to it. Greed is just greed. Jealousy is just that. It's just things are what they are. And it's when we reflect on things as they are, we see that they're not personal qualities. There's not a person in it. That's not a kind, because the personal illusion of personality always has to have a kind of like it, this is the way it is on a kind of permanent basis. Anger is my problem. I realize I have an angry problem. I get angry easily. I lose my temper. I'm impatient. And it's because when I was a child, I was frustrated all the time. And ever since that, frustration has made me very impatient. And we go on like that. And even though when we're not angry, we still assume that anger is ours, that we will get angry, and that anger is our problem. So we go around with this perception of a self as being one who becomes angry, one who becomes greedy, one who becomes jealous, one who becomes frightened, one who becomes this and that. And we believe that these are really kind of permanent personal qualities we have, and then of course it does become a problem for us. We create this very complicated personality out of it. But seeing anatta, penetrating perceptions, feelings, thoughts, habits, the body, all this, looking at it as anatta, contemplating that these are what they are, but it's not mine. This tendency to call it mine and me and all the shoulds and shouldn'ts, we let go of that. So anatta takes us to shunyata, or emptiness. Emptiness is the word for when there's no sense of self involved in the ability to see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, feel, is it? Means there's still seeing, there's still hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, there still can be thought, there's still feeling. But it's just what it is. It's empty of me and mine. We're no longer perceiving it from that position of this is mine, this is you, this is yours. So that there's this shunyata is the realization of anatta. So that these three, from anicca, we experience signlessness. From dukkha, we realize wishlessness. From anatta, we realize emptiness. Now, what is that? Is wishlessness, emptiness, signlessness. Now, this is where thought cannot take us, isn't it? We have to let go of thought. We have to let go of imagery, of symbols, of conditions, of all the conditioned world, to realize unconditioned. So words can only take us to this point. We can point to it with word, like a sign pointing to London, But we can't, but the sign pointing to London is not London, is it? We spend the whole day looking at the sign, we're still at the place where we are, which is not London. Even though it says London on it, L-O-N-D-O-N, says right there, London, but you're still at Hemel Hempstead. the sign is a cheat, isn't it? It's telling a lie. It's claiming to be something it isn't. But when you contemplate it, you realize that it's a sign pointing a direction, isn't it? It's not pointing to itself. It's not saying, I am London. It's saying, London, that way. With a kind of arrow pointing. You say, oh, this is not London. This is only the sign pointing the way. So that all these teachings are signs pointing the way. Paticca Samuppada, the Four Noble Truths. These are signs pointing the way. So just spending your time learning the teachings without doing the practice is like standing at the crossroads all the time looking at the sign. You never get anywhere. If you know you do maybe get acquainted with the sign. But then what's the purpose of that if you're not going where it's pointing to? You just get stuck, rooted in a place and can't move. Now with emptiness, the mind's empty, sunyata. Void. We think, I don't know if I like that. You know, I do like my food, and I do like flowers, and I do like the springtime. And I mean, if I live in emptiness, it means all these things will just be empty. There won't be anything left. They'll all disappear in my mind. I'll just be kind of a zombie. Maybe kind of, you know, things that just won't have anything but just a total kind of bland experience. Isn't there, in the way we talk in Buddhism, oftentimes people ask the question, if the kind of fear comes up and anxiety, that if we do this, if we realize Nibbana, we're not going to have anything left. Extinction. Just empty wishlessness and signlessness. Who wants that? We want love, we want warmth, meaning and purpose, inspiration, radiances, aesthetic beauty. We won't have these if we're extinct, empty, signless, and wishless. There's a picture of a kind of invisible person, isn't it? Kind of a being without any feeling. Because our perceptions all come from attachment, don't they? We can't imagine anything other than that which we're attached to. You can't, when you try to think of something signless, empty, and wishless, I mean, the mind goes blank, doesn't it? Mind does. You can't imagine anything. I can't imagine the unconditioned, the unborn, uncreated. What could be unconditioned, unborn, uncreated? Try to imagine what it could be. Is there an image for it? Can you think? What does it do to your mind? What was the unborn, uncreated, unoriginated? blank, doesn't it? Mind goes blank. Mind does. I can't imagine anything. Nothing comes to my mind. Unborn, uncreated, unoriginated. Could it be? It could be maybe. Might be possibly that blank, isn't it? You notice that when you can't think anymore, when your mind stops thinking, then what? So you begin to awaken yourself, really notice the ending of conditions, where when things end and cease, nirodha satya, and to really use experiences for investigating the ending, where the mind stops moving, where the thoughts cease, where the wishes end, where the signs cease, where there's no thought of self-involvement. There's still seeing. You can see without thinking about yourself. You can look at things without wishing and having desires, can't you? I can look at things without desire. I'm sure everyone else can. Hear without desiring. Smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, and that's emptiness. But there's not the desire. We're not creating desire onto it. We're not calling. We're not. And desire, of course, is from the self view, wanting to become, wanting to get rid of, wanting to have sensual gratifications, sensual distractions. Investigating the mind in this way, then we begin to feel a sense of trust in abiding in wishlessness or emptiness or signlessness. And if you notice during the retreat, when you're really feeling very peaceful and alert, there's no wishes in the mind. There's no sense of self. You're not thinking about yourself. You're not worried about yourself. You're not thinking about what you want to become, what you want to get rid of, what kind of sensual pleasures you'd like to experience. All that ceases. But there's still this natural state of awareness, and it's very, very pleasing to be there because it's so at ease, so peaceful, so clear, so strong. So that you begin to really note that. Notice. Investigate it. And it's a way of vipassana, looking into things so we really understand why things are as they are. In the empty mind, the wishlessness and signlessness, say there's, it's not an empty in as blank. So then, say, radiances and all these are potentials for us rather than desires. Intention becomes our way rather than desire. Compassion, joy, serenity, metta, kindness, all this is the way. But these are not from any kind of, no longer do they become sources of suffering for us because there's no attachment to them. We know so well the suffering that of attachment to fine material states or immaterial states, to the rupa, arupa worlds, to the material world. We know the suffering of attachment. We're so clear, so beyond any question. This is where you need to investigate phenomena and experience so that this isn't just a position of suppression that you're taking, but real insight. The whole range of conditioned phenomena that we experience here is our practice of investigation, of seeing, of reflecting. When you really see that clearly, then of course, say, we have this wonderful opportunity to say service. Now, how many of you think of service as a desirable or an interesting experience for your life? You like to say, well, most of us are good-hearted people, and we'd like to serve others. We'd like our lives to be of use, to be of value to others. I can't think of anything more horrible than living life for myself, just totally selfish. I mean, I personally cannot imagine anything more hellish, more miserable than living my life, this life in this form, only for myself as a personality. I find that totally repulsive, repugnant. That's the idea of it. I don't find that in any way attractive. So there is a longing to serve, to be of use to others. And how can that really happen if there's still selfish interest? Because from my own experience, one time before I was a monk, I used to try to get involved in all kinds of philanthropic causes. In America, I joined the Peace Corps for one thing. I was in the American Friends Service Committee in the Bay Area. Used to go to various kind of well-meaning organizations, try to work for the Red Cross for a year. The American Red Cross was all kinds of wanting, you know, desire to ambition to serve and be of use. But anything I did seemed to be kind of a flop. It became overwhelmed, like with the American Red Cross. I went through some terrible experiences. Not anything wrong with them, but just selfishness, immaturity, misunderstanding, fears and jealousies would arise, which make me quite incapable of being of use, much use to anyone. Worked in hospitals, but everything I did never was satisfying. It was too critical. I never could do things good enough. It was too much kind of ambition, or too much desire for approval, or envy, or fear, or that would overwhelm me. So then I became critical, like working for the American Friends Service Committee. By that time, I'd become very cynical, so I used to kind of feel very critical of the things they used to do. And then the American Peace Corps was quite cynical when I joined that. Though everything I did ended up in kind of mediocrity, or never a full-hearted, joyful experience, but half-heartedness, mediocrity was the result of it. So even trying to work from do good in the world from a selfish position always ended up with a lot of dukkha for me. This I don't know about you. So that it became quite clear to me that something had to come from a deeper level. I had to work on a more profound level than just altruism and high-minded ideas and good intentions. That one had to get to the root of suffering within the mind itself. So the selfishness of the Buddhist monk, leaving the world, real world behind, living in these Buddhist monasteries, not working for the welfare of the third world, not trying to help the downtrodden in the society, not trying to set everything right in the world, coming here, sitting here this for a whole month, 2 months, just sitting in this room, watching your breath, just sitting, what are you doing for anything? Just sitting here. You're not doing anything. You should be out doing something. That's what many people think. Because we don't seem to be doing anything, we're not worthwhile, it's not worthy. We should be doing something. But then there is this doing, isn't there? As you practice, you begin to see, to open, to understand. Something that no one else can ever know, isn't it? To the casual observer, it looks like you're just sitting kind of in a trance, sitting here. I can imagine some people just coming in and seeing a whole room filled with people just sitting there, full aversion. Look at them, they're just sitting there. They're not doing anything. Strangers coming by watching us do walking practice. That really drives them a bit funny, doesn't it? What are they doing? They're just walking back and forth. They've been doing that for a whole month now. I've seen that nun just walking back and forth in the same spot for a whole month. I remember hearing some comment at a meditation retreat one time. We were out walking, and I heard over on the other side of a hedge, a couple of young women, one with wheeling a pram, say, "What are they doing?" The other one saying, "I don't know, but I hate it." No, I don't, from my experience, which I can only speak from, and share that with you, is that opportunities for service do definitely increase in ways that one can really feel are worthwhile. Before I was a school teacher, before I became a monk, I was a school teacher. And I remember not being able to really feel totally committed to that profession, because I didn't really think that what I was teaching was that important. And so I wasn't fully committed to the values of education as being the most important thing we had to do in our lives. So I couldn't really kind of get very much zeal going in regards to living my whole life as a school teacher. I mean, I liked it. It wasn't that I disliked it either. Quite pleasant profession, actually. And I taught in Asia, so I found teaching in North Borneo a very pleasant kind of memories. In a Chinese school, I taught in a Chinese school. Very pleasant children. A lot easier to teach than American children. Much better behaved, actually. So they were very pleasant children to be with. And yet I never could feel very, very really enthusiasm or that I really wanted to do this in a kind of for my life work, teaching English. 2 years I was teaching The Cat Is on the Mat. Teaching primary school students basic English. Well, then I also thought of training to become I was also in the back of my mind, I was going to become a lecturer in a university teaching Asian history. That sounded a little more interesting. But then I thought, teaching Asian history for the rest of my life, you know, is that really important? Is that what people need to know, Asian history? Could I really fully commit myself to teaching Asian history till I retire at 60? No, I wouldn't be able to really get into that either, not really wholeheartedly. There'd still be a lot of me that would not be committed to that. It would be just a way of making a living, an interesting profession. There were opportunities for interesting work. In the monastic life, I felt, I tried to think, is there something better than this that I could do? Ask yourself, in a sense of, is there something better than what we're doing? Something more worthy, more worthwhile? And I personally can't think of anything better, something more worthy than this. I just can't. I've tried. Becoming President of the United States? No. Prime Minister of Britain? No. Head of the United Nations? Even if you're a rice farmer or a organic food grower or a maker of windmills, or a hermit, or nuclear scientist. I think on the level of what I really feel is most important, most meaningful, most significant, then this fulfills those qualities for me. Then, say, as one develops the life, one has something to offer. One is making offerings to others. Like these monasteries are kind of deliberate intentions to set up places for people to hear the Dhamma and practice. These monasteries are not for me, believe me. Life would be much more simple for me without them. Much more simple, less complicated on the external without these monasteries in England, Switzerland, New Zealand, Australia. I wouldn't have to go on these long tours. Well, on the personal plane, there's certainly nothing for oneself. But it is a way of serving, isn't it? What monks can offer is try to set up situations for other people, like meditation retreats. Setting up this retreat, making it possible so that you could practice. This is how we can serve, by encouraging everyone here to practice Dhamma, to make oneself available for that, to try to make oneself as available as much as possible for, say, teaching, for inspiration, encouragement, whatever that one can offer. Where does it end? You don't think about it on the personal plane. That's no longer a personal thing, so it's no longer, there's nothing made of it into, say, burdensome personal conditions or perceptions. But it is a way of serving, isn't it? Serving the society. And keeping one's self open for other possibilities. Not going around trying to make everything right and set everything up or straighten everything out from ideas, but one is quite willing to investigate all realms, all potentials, all possibilities for compassionate action and service to other beings. Not that one is just thinking, this is all I'm going to do. Because there's a self-view in that, isn't it? So where this takes us, who knows? This has to be always left in that state of mystery, of not knowing, of a kind of wonder, of where it takes us all, what will happen to us all, what will take place? Will the world be blown up with nuclear weapons in the next few years? Or will there be a golden age, a blossoming, Aquarian values and a spiritual awakening? All that. This is still the unknown, isn't it? But as you develop that spiritual potential within yourself, you realize that spiritual awakening is not impossible. If I can do it, you can do it. One thing one sees is that you don't have to be kind of specially kind of gifted character, Superman or Messiah or an avatar. A human being. It's a teaching for manusia and deva, for intelligent and virtuous beings, for beings who have who know the difference between right and wrong, is minutia, have a moral sense, can tell the difference between right and wrong. So the teaching is something that, since all of you have that ability to know the difference, to know what is right, what is wrong, is relative, yes, and not absolute, but you, in a given situation, most of us have enough sense to know what is the right thing to do and what is the wrong thing to do, then this means that we have this ability to penetrate and to investigate, to realize Dhamma. This is not a mean thing or a small thing or just a pastime, a little hobby we have. This is something that one can dedicate one's whole being to. And that's the beauty of it. It's something one wants to dedicate one's whole life to, because it's so worthy, so beautiful in itself, and significant, and gives us this, gives us a direction, some worthy direction to our brief life experience on this planet. So if you'll take a short break now.